Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
In perhaps one of the hottest topics of the day, BOSPAR Principal Curtis Sparrow has joined us to talk about sexual harassment in the workplace. A link to his website will be on Recalculating Biz tonight. But first, we want to talk to Curtis about sexual harassment and what it means, particularly in relation to small business. Curtis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Curtis, first tell us a little bit about yourself and what BOSPAR does before we do anything else.
Okay. I'm the principal of BOSPAR. It's a PR agency with offices in San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and Washington, and L.A. And we help tech companies articulate their story and explain it, because sometimes the technology is so far out there that it's difficult for the rest of us to understand, and so we help them figure it out. And what we did is we did research about what sort of, responses the American public get when they hear people apologize for sexual harassment or for any crisis in the workplace. And what we discovered is that a lot of people take a sort of suspicious view when they hear stuff like the accusations are untrue, or from the bottom of my heart, or when someone blames a conspiracy, or, and I know everyone has heard this one before, especially when someone blames fake news.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. I'm going to first start and let Dan begin. I have a lot of questions, but I'm sure Dan does as well.
So good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. I have written a number. I write for about 8 different blogs, and I've written some commentary on this issue that you're talking about. And, you know, I'm going to give you 3 examples. Charlie Rose, Matt Lauer, and our esteemed senator from the state of Minnesota, I like to call him Stuart Smalley from his Saturday Night Live days. When these 3 men and some others came out after they were accused of their activities, I was actually quite angry at what was going on. Angry about several things, but it seemed to me that all 3 men and many others all start out with the same words, and those words that they were embarrassed. Now, the first words were not about any apology to the women that they may have abused. They were embarrassed. They didn't say what they were embarrassed about, whether they were embarrassed that they got caught or whether they were embarrassed in their activities. But they apparently were not embarrassed up until the day before they were caught and outed. I thought it was like somebody had sent out a script. Here's what you say. The first thing you say is, I'm embarrassed. I mean, how does Charlie Rose say that he's embarrassed when he's accused of parading around in his birthday suit or a robe on that's open and people coming into his home? He's embarrassed. And it just seems to me terribly, terribly inappropriate the way to begin. And so then I agree with what you're saying, and that is this highly suspect of how sincere their apology when it eventually comes is.
Yeah, I think in any apology, you need to first show remorse to the hurt party. So I agree that taking on the case of embarrassment and making that the very first flag you want to fly shows that you're still thinking about yourself and not who you wronged. And so that's why I think there is a kind of a moral upchuck when people hear that sort of priorities in an apology. First you say you're sorry to the victim, and then you could talk about yourself. But I think if I was a politician, I would first apologize to the person harmed, then I'd apologize to my constituents, and then maybe I would describe a little bit of my reaction to it and how I'm going to make the situation better. And I think the problem that we've had with all of these situations is that they've been very focused on the perpetrator, and we have not really heard how they're going to make the world a better place or what they're going to do differently. They've basically done some form of, I'm ashamed of this, and it's too bad, and that's it. But they've not really done anything to make the situation better for the future for their daughters or their son.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me about what you're saying is that my partner, Mr. Mazzola, said to me in a conversation, the difference between Democrats and Republicans, and I'm trying to quote him as exactly as I can, is that Republicans tend to have relationships with a single woman for many, many years. Democrats seem to go from one to another on a regular basis. They don't have short-term, they don't have long-term relationships with the women that they have sexual relations with. So I don't know whether that's true or not. I just thought it was an interesting insight by my partner, which makes a hell of a lot of sense to me. I wanted to ask you, does your company provide counsel to individuals and or corporations that have employees with these issues?
So what we do is when a company has a crisis, they will come to us and they'll say, we have a crisis, this is what happened. And then what we do is we enact a crisis plan that we have already worked with them to develop, because we believe that the first way of dealing with a crisis is preparing for it well in advance. And so then it's a matter of how we respond. Usually a good crisis plan involves bringing in a third party so that there's someone objective who can be helping out. And then it's a matter of what kind of crisis is it? Is it a HR crisis? Is it a legal crisis? Or is it a technological crisis? And so each crisis is the same in so much as you want to prepare, respond, and recover. But each crisis is different in the sense of the details that manifest.
Yeah, many, many years ago, and I at the moment I can't tell you how many, but it was a lot. I took a crisis management course at the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, and that course was designed to try and help management of companies to deal with a crisis when it hits. At that particular time, as I said, it was many decades ago. At that particular time, the people that were teaching the course were saying that many corporations have no crisis management. And you look around at what's going on in our business world today, whether it's the hacking of tens of millions of customer files or a number of things, automobiles that have been modified to pass tests and are not reality, and on and on and on. It appears that there are still many, many corporations, even big corporations, who have no crisis management plans, and that their managing the crisis on the fly. Is that true?
Oh, there are so many people who are managing on the fly. And when they do, we see all sorts of goofy, unforced errors. And so I think that when we have seen examples like with United, for example, or with other companies responding to a crisis, lurching from statement to statement, you get a sense that they're making it up as they go along. And that's a real problem
right. These
days.
So when you see the United or the Volkswagen or the banks or the credit companies having all these problems and you see the responses, do you cringe?
Well, it's more like a moment of Cassandra from the Iliad, where I just raise up my hand and say, why? Why didn't they listen? Because there's always someone who's saying, you know, we really should be preparing for this ahead of time. We really should be thinking, is this a good idea? Or if it's not a good idea, what can we do? And so I think if I was a business owner listening to this right now, my big thought would be, what is our crisis plan? Do we have one? And what can we do to make sure that if a crisis hits us, that we are ready to act and act calmly. I know that airlines, for example, what their professionals have confided in me, and I'm not going to give any names since it was confided, is that the easiest crisis for them to deal with is a plane crash, because they have a full book that they just go through page after page after page that walks them through each step methodically. The problem is that most companies don't have such a similar book for other crises that come out, whether they are hacked or whether there is an HR complaint. These companies do not have a detailed plan of attack, and that's what we're saying is needed. And it's clear that in our research with Americans, one of the first things people wanted to do wanted to hear from a company when a problem happened is a explanation within 24 hours that's in simple, easy to understand English. And that's been missing from American corporate life for a long time. You may remember that Uber was recently announced that it was hacked, but it did not come forward with the details until about a year later. And that kind of cover-up is the thing that drives American consumers nuts.
Yeah, we had the same problem with Yahoo. Waited a year to announce a significant breach in their security. Don, go ahead.
Yeah. Curtis, I wanted to bring up something that came out of a focus group we did about a month ago. You know, we're aimed specifically at small business leaders. And we all agree that most small businesses are ill-equipped. But and everybody seems to be now jumping on and saying that women and men victims are always correct. But in the focus group that we had, that two presidents, one was a woman and one was a man, both talked about what they felt were unjustified accusations. Leveled at managers because the people were in danger of getting fired. Has your survey talked about that or done anything, or how do you feel about it, or do you want to address it at all?
You know, I think that terminations from issues like this are not something that I could easily put in a one-size-fits-all sort of statement. I do know that when there is a big crisis that's happened, Americans overwhelmingly want someone fired for gross negligence. The question becomes defining gross negligence and what does it mean? And it's almost kind of that thing where people are like, I can't explain it, but when I see it, I can clearly recognize it. And I think, for example, in the situation of Uber, there was a definite strong feeling of gross negligence in terms of how long it took for the company to reveal it. And I think over a year is it might be definitely the red line in gross negligence when it comes to alerting customers about breaches of information. So I'm not sure if I can give an exact answer, but that might be the best I can give you.
Well, we're only searching for answers. We try to get as much information. But do you think that harassment is increasing, decreasing, or about the same over the years in your experience?
My suspicion is that the awareness of harassment and what constitutes harassment is increasing. I think that people have finally reached a breaking point in what they will tolerate and what they'll accept. And I think that the situation with the Me Too campaign has really crystallized that. And so I think executives in every company, large and small, are taking a real hard look at how they do business and how their employees do business as well.
Dan, back to you.
Sure. Thank you. I did a piece, as I mentioned to you, on this whole subject matter, and I raised the question as to how that it's going to affect the two things. One, the workplace environment, and two, the relationships between men and women. And I suggested, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, that the demand for sex robots might appreciate dramatically.
You know, I actually work with AI companies, and I can tell you that one of our clients discovered that men would flirt with AIs with female names. And so I went through the records, and it was kind of astonishing just how many guys would begin flirting with robotic women. So I do think you're onto something. I also think one of the things that I see as a small business guy is my company is all virtual. We all work from home. And one thing I've noticed that's different than a physical office is that when you work virtually, the HR complaints of any kind drop dramatically, because you don't have a physical space in which to say something wrong or off color or come off the wrong way. And so I suspect more and more companies will go virtual as they try to cut down on the overhead of having a building space, but also the relative slings and arrows of HR problems like harassment.
I would say to you that there have been a lot of studies done about the social isolation of people working independently from home, that there used to be a chemistry by being in the same place with more than one person to synergize ideas and concepts. Much more difficult to do that over the internet and through social media. Not impossible, but perhaps not as productive. Go ahead.
You know, I think that there is an interesting point, and that there have been a lot of different things that companies have done that have had trade-offs. For example, mm-hmm. I came from an open workplace environment, and I promise you, it was nearly impossible to do any critical thinking in a space where everyone was talking around you. And so mm-hmm. I think that as offices evolve, there's always going to be trade-offs. I completely understand what you're saying about the social isolation, but that's why we've been using video conferencing, for example, as a way of getting around that. And mm-hmm. so I find that by doing that and by also having regular meetups, that isolation really, that feeling of isolation is really diminished because you have it's your time at work, even if it's in your home office, is punctuated with a lot of activity.
So let me move on to another facet of this issue. I'm going to make another observation, and you can tell me whether I'm crazy or not. We've already talked about how the interpersonal relationship between men and women might change regardless of the workforce. But in the workforce, I'm just wondering out loud with you, is it possible that this issue actually turns out to be more detrimental to women than they're thinking? Will the male leadership in corporations today change their demeanor and their interaction with women that may restrict their promotion ability?
I would think not. I think that I think we're really at a turning point where we are in a stone's throw of gender equality, and I don't think any male executive would want to risk being seen as a caveman by undermining the career of women for fear of what could happen in the future. So I would suspect that what's going to be happening is that things are rapidly going to move to gender equality within the United States. And I think the laggards are going to be viewed as kind of like the Saudi Arabias of the world.
Okay, let me give you another statistic. I have a foundation that deals with wounded soldiers and veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, sleep deprivation, and working in suicide prevention.
Mm-hmm.
The Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs, a year ago, October, for the first time in the history of the VA, began to release data based on sex. The suicide rate for male veterans, is four times the civilian population.
Mm-hmm.
The suicide rate for female veterans is 12 times the suicide rate for their sisters in civilian life. Over 55% of women veterans said they were sexually harassed at least one time during their active duty service. And there are estimated 600,000 out of 2.1 million women veterans who are diagnosed, probably more, with post-traumatic stress disorder. When interviewed why such a high level of sexual harassment, many of the women responded that they felt that the male soldier in a combat situation would not have confidence that the female soldier would have his back. That does she have the strength, if I'm wounded, to pull me out of a bunker? And so much of the harassment was a function of life and death on the part of soldiers in a combat situation. So here we have our military that has what some could construe a huge problem of a bias against women, and a huge percentage of the women have said that they were harassed while they were on active duty. How do we turn that one?
Well, that's just so beyond my pay grade at the moment. I'm not sure how I could give a succinct answer. I can say this, that I believe that it was the absolute right thing to do to desegregate the armed forces and have troops serve together regardless of their ethnic background. And I believe it's still the right thing to do to have men and women serve together and alongside each other. I think that people, regardless of gender, definitely have differences where sometimes there are women who I think would be stronger and better suited for a job than a man. And so I would say that my kind of guiding hope is that we play to our strengths, whether it's a military force or a small, medium-sized company or a big enterprise, and we give opportunity for all, but that we also reward excellence and support it. And I know that's kind of a whiffy answer because it's kind of like I'm having the whole thing, and in many ways it is. But I definitely think that companies and organizations that aim for diversity have been shown to perform better than those organizations that seem to slant one way or the other.
Do you think that the magnitude of the public sexual harassment reports in Hollywood and the news media and the political party, is that going to have a fundamental change on those people that have to go to an office to work?
I think that there is a strong change that is already underway because of what happened with Weinstein and others. I mean, you're seeing a level of awareness within Hollywood that is unheard of. And one thing that I think is underplayed or not played up enough in the popular media is how this is actually going on not just with the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, but also the Kevin Spaceys and the Bryan Singers of the world as well, where whether or not there are truth to these allegations, there is concerns about the image of propriety. And so I would say that there is, first of all, there is nearly no tolerance for even the kind of perhaps perception of impropriety. I think that sort of relaxed atmosphere is gone. I also think that this shows that men in power in general, whether they are gay or straight, tend to behave in certain ways, or at least are tempted to behave in certain ways. So I wouldn't say this is merely a male-female dynamic. I think it's really what happens with men in general. And so I think that there is something about our DNA, our primordial makeup, that creates the temptation for this sort of behavior. And so I do want to say that I think this is beyond a man versus woman thing and more like a what is man made of and how do they develop as they go up their corporate ladder.
So it sounds like you're saying, believe it or not, folks, there is a difference between men and women.
I am saying that there is a difference between men and women, absolutely. And, you know, that just goes from, like, you know, our early days of a species. And I think you would see that along the lines. I do think also, however, that when you consider that the marketplace is, I believe, a majority female, that I think it tends to help companies on either side of the spectrum to make sure that they have a diverse leadership and workforce so that they can be relevant to all sectors of society.
I think I'm right that there are more women employed in the workforce than men now. Is that correct?
That's my belief as well. I think that there are also more women college graduates these days.
Don, I think he wants to ask a question.
I hate to break in. It's been such a fascinating conversation, but Curtis,
so.
would you? Curtis, will you tell us your website again and how people can reach you?
Absolutely. Our website is bospar.com. That is B as in boy, O as in octopus, S as in Sam, P as in Peter, A as in apple, R as in Robert.com. And if you go to our website, you can read all the ways in which we recommend people deal with various corporate and business issues as well as PR issues. And should you want to, you know, bring us on to help, you know, contact success@bospar.com, and we'll be happy to reach out to you and figure something out.
Thank you so
much for joining
us today.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book. Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Today, Dan, because you and I think so much about security of our listeners' data, it's important to have another expert to join us, as Kurt Long is today. But he's more than just the CEO and founder of Fair Warning, a leading cloud-based data security provider. He also has some profound thoughts on being an entrepreneur. Kurt, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you, Don, for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about yourself, your company, and where people can learn more about you, and then we'll get into more detail.
Sure. The company is Fair Warning. You can just visit fairwarning.com or www.fairwarning.com. You can see the specifics of my, you know, my background on LinkedIn. I'm really easy to find, and easy to find on Facebook as well. But Fair Warning protects confidential information of patients, like protected health information, wealth, so persons with securities accounts or any kind of bank accounts. Anything that is high value, we protect, and then banking around the world as well. So health, wealth, and banking, and we do that for cloud-based applications. And we started out in electronic health records and grew a really big market share there, over 40% of good-sized care providers across the U.S. and around the world, parts of around the world. use fair warning to protect patient information. And as you can imagine, between the confidential information and the growth of cloud, it's a super, super busy time for us. So that's a quick introduction to fair warning. What else could I share?
Well, that's a start, but I'm going to turn it over to Dan because Dan usually has some pertinent questions to our guests.
Okay.
Kurt, thank you for joining us today on this very important subject of security. I feel like we're almost bombarded every day with some kind of a breach on internet security, whether it's tens of millions or hundreds of millions of files or small business. And I need to ask you a question, and the question is not by any means designed to put you on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to clarify something because I'm a registered investment advisor. I've been managing money for 43 years. Have brokerage accounts at major brokerage firms all over the nation, and there are some people who are in the cloud security business who are running commercials saying that hackers can steal your 401k. Now I know what the procedures are in Wall Street in order to get money out of your account. And I think I'm not going to mention the people that are doing it, but I think there's a disservice to the American consumer when certain data security people are scaring them by saying that your 401k or the equity in your home is at risk. Is that a fair criticism?
I'm going to stay out of it on is it a fair criticism, but I'll just tell you how I kind of view it. And that is just the way you expressed it to me and the way when I hear these kinds of commercials, you know, they tend to be designed to drive fear into people. And when it's done at such a detailed level, it's usually, you know, the fear is going to be used in a way that I wouldn't approve of. You know, it's not the style or philosophy or the ethics that I would have. So I can't tell you exactly if someone could have their 401k transferred. I bet you there are under certain circumstances, but the overall tone certainly isn't, I'm not sure it's a constructive tone. You know, so for us, we think it more in terms of trust. We think that while we do need to protect data from the bad guys, and make no mistake whatsoever, there's more bad guys out there than you would ever imagine. They're organized, they're well-funded. We still need to be in the business of building trust in the world, trust between wealth management companies and their clients, trust between banks and their clients, and trust between care providers and their patient. So, Dan, we're always going to come at it from a even though our job's a little dirty, and we have to catch the bad guys, you know, my lens is always going to be to talk about how we grow trust in the world, not to instill fear. Yeah.
Well said. Thank you for that. I really appreciate that. We basically have a show that's based on helping small business, and the government generally defines small businesses of organizations under 500 employees, but a huge percentage of the small businesses in the United States might be the boss and a couple of employees. Let's talk a little bit about what your company might do for what we could call a micro business, which is, you know, the boss and a couple of employees. What do they need to be concerned about, and can you help them, or are they too small?
So businesses, as you well know, they come in all shapes and sizes, but their customer data is, if I'm a three-person business, and I've been a three-person business, by the way. I started the company when it was just me, and then it was me and another guy, and, you know, me and four other guys. I've been there. And then now we're a more sizable business of some significance. And so I've been there with those small business owners, and I'd have to say my data was probably more valuable to me the smaller I was, because if I lost it or someone stole it, I really couldn't have afforded to have a lawsuit. Or if I did, it was going to be, you know, really difficult on the finances. So a lot of times I'll hear what I think is an errant philosophy, which is, hey, listen, I'm too small and, you know, I don't have to worry about these things. And I would say just the opposite, because today we're a much bigger business and, you know, I take the data super, super seriously at Fair Warning, but we're much more resilient and I could withstand more, you know, more difficulties in the area of security. Another comment I want to make is just because of the size of a business doesn't speak to the importance of the data. So we have a lot of customers, and again, I'll keep pivoting back to wealth management or equities trading companies. You know, they certainly could be 100 employees or less, even 50 employees and less, but they manage hundreds of millions of dollars or even billions of dollars in behalf of their clients. So just because a business is small doesn't mean the data isn't incredibly important to everybody involved. And to answer specifically about whether Fair Warning can help with them or not, I'm not sure. If they're using cloud applications like Salesforce to manage their prospects, or they're using Office 365 or other cloud-based applications, you know, we probably could help them. But I think more importantly as to whether Fair Warning could help them, my message would be please take the data seriously, and the size of your business doesn't matter, because it just it matters at every size for all your customers and for yourself.
So while we're on that subject, just again, what is the website that people could reach you?
Sure, www.fairwarning.com, you know, warning.com.
And do you only work over the internet, or do you have offices around the country?
Yeah, we have customers around the world, and we have people around the world. We do most of our work from our headquarters here in Clearwater, Florida, great place to be, you know, especially this time of year. It's why I stayed here and founded Fair Warning, and we can talk a little bit about that later. But we literally have customers all over the world and representatives to serve them there as well.
Well, I live over on Sanibel on the West Coast, so it's
so you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. What are the are there particular types of, and I don't know whether hackers is the right way to describe what I want to ask you, but are there particular things that are happening today in terms of attacks that that have more concern to you than others?
I'm going to keep putting, you know, you've asked me to think about, you know, the podcast is maybe addressing businesses 500 people and below. And we have customers, 200,000 employees, all the way down to customers of 10 or 20 employees. But I'm going to frame it within the context of what I would worry about as a smaller business owner. For a small business owner, you need to make some good decisions about who you partner with for your security. And that partnership might just mean that, hey, I keep my data in Salesforce, and we think Salesforce is secure. Office 365. And, you know, they do a good job of security controls. And there are bad actors that are outside your business, you know, on the dark web or in another country that might want to break into your company and steal that data. But chances are, you know, that data could be stolen by an internal employee. That happened to me, quite frankly. I think when we were like 10 or 20 people, and I told you, you know, how hard that was on a business of at an early stage. And I had someone steal all of our customer data, or at least I felt like they did, and I felt like they took it with them. And it was someone that I worked with, and quite frankly, from a work relationship point of view, I had tremendous respect for. But when it came time for them to leave the business for whatever reason, you know, they decided that my data was their data. And they exported out of the system. And they took it with them, and I had to spend considerable amount of money to prove that they exported that data, and I brought a lawsuit against them. I don't know if I've ever bought another lawsuit in my life against everyone. I'd have to think carefully. I don't think so, but I'm not a litigious person. But gosh, that was our data, and I had a group of people that counted on it. And when that guy left, I couldn't believe it. And that, in part, became inspiration for a new product that we call Fair Warning for Salesforce. And so my message, Dan, is, yeah, there are absolutely bad guys out there on the outside, but don't forget that person that you're working with, when they decide to leave, they might want to start their own business, their own wealth management company, or they might decide that, you know, your Rolodex is their Rolodex at the next company that they work for, and they take it with them.
So let's use that experience, and let me ask you a question. If we roll back in time, looking at what happened to you, and mm-hmm. I know I'm putting you on the spot, and I guess that's part of my job is to try.
100% comfortable. No problems.
If you went back, knowing what you know today, mm-hmm. of your years of experience,
yeah,
what is there anything that you could have done to protect that data before that person left?
That's a really, really good question. And I think because we were in the security and privacy business, we were doing a lot of things right. And let me just give you a checklist of a few things that are right. You always want to have intellectual property agreements signed with your employees, meaning that they acknowledge that they have access to your intellectual property. It's not theirs. And if they generate that intellectual property, including customer lists, or pipeline, sales pipeline, that's your sales pipeline. So we had that. We had non-disclosures in place. We had basic security controls in place. I probably could have done a little better job with security awareness training after people were on board. In other words, not just at the sign-up time, but on an ongoing basis. But the one thing I didn't have a system that could monitor what the salespeople or what the employees did when they were using Salesforce. It literally, the technology didn't exist. And so when this person left, I had a hunch, but I really couldn't prove it. And that became the inspiration, for a product that, we've now brought to market and sold all around the world. It's growing exponentially. It's called Fair Warning for Salesforce. And what that product does, it allows me to monitor and report on what people are accessing in those applications. And let's tie in one more thing, that also, because we're able to do that, we're able to let everybody know, hey, we trust and respect you, but this data is sensitive to the business's well-being. So we do monitor, and when you offboard, we're going to look back and see what data you exported. And I was missing that piece, but now I've tried to build that, Dan, and turn that into, a big market opportunity. But I guess that's what entrepreneurs do.
Yeah. No, I think that was a great story of using your own personal experience to figure out what you had done wrong, and then using your creativity as an entrepreneur to build something that fixed the problem and created a whole new line of business for you. I mean, that's what entrepreneurship is all about, isn't it?
I think so. And the parts, I love products where I can understand what it's like to be in the other person's shoes. I just love those kind of businesses where I have direct experiences that make me empathetic to the person that I'm selling to, and that I could come out from a place of, man, I've been in your shoes, I know what that's like, and here's a solution. Let me understand your problem a little better, but here's a potential solution. And you can connect all the dots there. That's when I get most inspired.
Yeah. It's interesting. We had another guy on a month or so ago in security and also echoed what you were saying about don't be totally concerned about who's going to hack you from outside. Your biggest threat can be somebody inside. And you're reinforcing what he was saying, and he's reinforcing what you're saying, is that's an area probably where most small businesses are not paying enough attention. So how does your new system help in that?
Yeah, the first thing I want to say is it's hard. When you're a small business and you work close together and you see everybody face-to-face, and whether that's 10 people, 5 people, 30 people, it's so hard to believe that you can't trust others around you. But if you're in business long enough, you're going to find out that it's kind of like I've trademarked something you might not believe I have the trademark on, trust but verify. listen, I have to trust the people, but boy, I better verify that they're not jeopardizing my business and taking my sales pipeline and taking it with them on my customer list and pivoting over and hurting everybody around me. So trust but verify is a good way to live. And the way the new system works is we just watch for unusual access patterns and fair warning for Salesforce to say, is someone accessing more customer records by a large margin than they have in the past? Are they exporting the customer list at an unusual time of night, like when they're working and maybe even working from home from another computer, not on the computer they normally work on from work? Are there escalated privileges? Did people create new administrative accounts? Are people accessing so that they give them more rights to do things they shouldn't? They call that escalated privileges. And are people just in general looking at records that they have no business looking at? Those are the kinds of things that we do. And then you monitor for those, and you create this culture where if you see people doing these things, you talk to them about it. You know, it doesn't have to be accusatory. You don't have to accuse them of stealing the customer list. But you begin letting people know, when I see these unusual behaviors, hey, I'm going to walk by Bill's desk and just say, hey, Bill, you know, hey, I noticed you exported the customer list. Is there a reason for that? You know, oh, I didn't realize you're in accounting, and you just needed to load all the new customers into the new accounting system, right? And that's the only reason you exported it. But now Bill knows and everybody knows that you're at least paying attention and assign a high value to the data of the business, you know? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wanted to ask you another question about that.
Yeah.
If you could choose one or the other, and maybe you can't, but it would seem to me, based on the conversation we're having with you, that in small business, the more likely scenario is somebody from inside your organization is going to try and take your data, as opposed to the Russians or the North Koreans or the Chinese trying to hack in. Is that an inappropriate?
You know, Dan, I have a master's degree in mathematics, so I don't like making statements that I can't prove, right? But but since you're putting me on the spot, you know, and we have this radio interview, I'm going to give you an answer and say, yeah, that's right. Even though I don't have the specific statistics to prove at the tip of my tongue, if I were a small business owner, I would do everything I could to get the right partners in place to protect my data from the outside world, but I'd be particularly paranoid and put more of my personal energy into understanding, are there people or here in the business, you know, that might not be as trustworthy as I thought they would, or give me signs they might leave and take my data. So yeah, I think that's a fair characterization.
I think it's been a fascinating, and I hate to break in, you're on a great roll, Dan, but our guest wanted to also talk about being an entrepreneur, and since we have limited time, what are your thoughts on being an entrepreneur and on being someone who's taken a company from an idea to success? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm going to keep it super simple. And that was from the very beginning of my career, even as a young person when I was 21, just graduating from college, I wanted to work on things that inspired me personally and that would inspire me at work. And then also I wanted to be inspired outside of work at what I did. And so I started, I kind of had a dream come true that I worked very hard on to make come true. And that was to work at Kennedy Space Center in the real-time launch data bank for the space shuttle program. And I really, really wanted to be involved in the Hubble Space Telescope. I know you're saying it doesn't have anything to do with business. What does that have to do? And I lived on right on the Atlantic Ocean, and we would work on the space program and the associated missions in the day. And then in the late afternoons and early evenings, I would, you know, surf, and I would windsurf. And, you know, meet new people. And all this was inspirational to me. Like, it was a dream come true. And so I just started learning at a very real age, really early age, that if I work on things that I love and truly inspire me, that I'm going to come back and do more of it, and I get better, and I get rewarded for being better, and then I can do things that I really love, like windsurfing waves at the time or surfing big waves, and that makes me excited, and I got into this virtuous cycle of adventure and taking risk and building businesses. And at the Space Center, just last two things, at the Space Center I specifically learned to believe in something bigger than myself. Like, the space program was so big and so intellectually challenging that there's no way you could sit there and think this is all about me. You had to tip your hat to all the people that you work with. So I believed in something that was bigger than myself, and I tried to carry that over into my entrepreneurial career. And then secondly, I really focused in on giving back to the team and managing risk, because we were in the business of risky things when we did big things. And when we think about ourselves as a team, I was always trying to de-risk the part that I was on, because we were already doing something hard and dangerous. And then I love carrying that into my personal life of, you know, can we do really big things that are super, super fun and de-risk them? Can I start businesses that are bigger than myself and de-risk them? And that's how that cycle got going.
Well, one more question. If you had to tell our audience the two things to be a successful entrepreneur, what would they be?
They're probably not what the audience might think. It's listen. You have to be a great listener. For whatever reason, of all the attributes that I have, I probably am a better listener than a big percentage of other people. And the second thing is genuinely be empathetic and build value with your customer. Like, understand where they're at and then build value in their lives. So listen, problem solve, build value. And then hopefully you can either personally sell and market, or you can get people around you could do that. But the core of entrepreneurship, it's listen, problem solve, be empathetic to your customer.
Dan, you get to ask the last two questions.
Okay, thank you. Kurt, following what you just did with Don, do you look for, when you're hiring people for your company, regardless of the position that you're hiring for, do you look for people that have entrepreneurial tendencies? Can you spot it? Can you spot an entrepreneur a mile away?
I would have answered yes to that all the time. But you don't have to have that for every position. So I love being surrounded by entrepreneurial people, people that are willing to listen, take risk, understand the customers, all this stuff. But there are some positions, like operational roles, like when you're running a data center that's supporting, you know, billions and billions of rows of data for customers around the world, you know, and also in my finance department, you know, where we have accounting and I have to sign off on our, you know, our accredited financials, you know, I might dial back the risk-taking element just a little bit, look for maybe a great listener and empathetic to the customer. But if they're a little conservative, that's okay, you know, for some spots. But otherwise, I love working with entrepreneurial people the way we just talked about.
And the last question is, how do you get new customers? Is it by referral? How do you find new relationships?
All of the above, you know, and anything you can think of, we probably do. You know, it's going to start with having the way to get your next great customer is through your existing customer, that you've made them super, super happy, delivered more value than you promised. And they refer you, but for sure, you know, everything from on the internet to regional events to webinars to case studies to PR and media like we're doing today. It's all of the above, but every single one of them starts with having your existing customers be happy and satisfied with your products.
On that note, we're talking with Kurt Long, who's CEO and founder of Fair Warning, a leading cloud-based data security provider, and a very articulate spokesman for entrepreneurship. Kurt, your website again?
www.fairwarning.com.
It's been an absolutely fascinating time, And I'm so glad I got to listen to most of it because I learned a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don. Yeah, thank you, Don. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating.